Congratulations! You have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lambcast. I'm your host, Richard Kirkham from Kirkham A Movie A Day. Inspirational films about students and teachers at elite boarding schools seem to be a dime a dozen. Since the early days of cinema sound, filmmakers have gravitated towards schools as a place for drama. It makes sense, because you usually have a collection of distinct personalities, conflict with authority, nostalgia for your classmates, and your own time in school, driving the audiences to these movies. From Mr. Chips to John Keating, elite prep schools have been the source of all kinds of film themes. Some serious dramas like School Ties deal with prejudice. Some like School of Rock are straight comedies about creativity and the desire to break from conformity. Scent of a Woman is ultimately about the ethical choices that young people are faced with. The new film The Holdovers from Alexander Payne plumbs many of the same notes, and so it may seem derivative to some, but that's what we're here to talk about. For the moment, I'll play headmaster and introduce the students who are fomenting rebellion here on the Lambcast. Rachel Wagner and her reviews are typical of the outstanding class of students here at our academy, sharp, well-prepared, and elevating the level of conversation. Welcome, Rachel.
Glad to be here. Thank you for that great introduction.
Nicole Ayers of Mad Lab Post is one of those students you know will excel out of class. She needs just a little discipline, but very little encouragement to express herself in class.
Right on.
And finally, it's not hard to imagine him as the rebellious nonconformist who returns to the school after graduation to become an inspirational teacher who, after a number of years, also becomes a slight curmudgeon. Howard Kasner of Pop Art.
Believe it or not, Mr. Kirkham, there was a time when the fire in my loins burned white hot.
My toes are curling already. Well, IMDb describes the premise of the film quite simply. A cranky history teacher at a remote prep school is forced to remain on campus over the holidays with a troubled student who has no place to go. It sounds like a familiar theme, but I think there are a lot of directions that this movie goes that maybe were not expected, and of course it does go in some places that you do expect. We're going to start with general thoughts, keep it spoiler-free for the first part of the show, but obviously at some point we'll probably cross the Rubicon, and I don't know if we'll sprain our shoulders or if we'll actually break some bones when we do that, but we'll wait a while to get to that particular point. Rachel, let's start with you. Generally, what did you think about the film?
I absolutely adored it. I had a pretty good feeling about it going into it, that it was going to be my cup of tea. And it totally was. I absolutely just loved all of the characters. I loved the banter, the writing back and forth. It was funny. It was sincere. It was sweet. I felt like I got to know the three main characters so well. And that they were, I felt bonded to them by the end in a way that I haven't felt for a lot of movies this year. And so, I gave it an extremely high score. And it's got the Christmas feels. I love that, obviously. Huge win for me.
All right. Howard, what about you?
Well, on Facebook, I said it's a feel-good movie that gives feel-good movies a good name.
I like that phrase.
That's good.
It is familiar, but I was constantly surprised at the same time, even when it took familiar directions. I think it misses some political, it misses when it comes to racial politics. And I was a little disappointed in that because there are opportunities that I thought called for it. But the acting is wonderful. Divine Joy Randolph. Just incredible. And she's supposed to win the Oscar this year for supporting actress. Paul Giamatti is great. It looks great. It's a very witty script that, even though it goes in familiar places, just in many ways kept surprising me.
All right. Well, it sounds so far like The Holdovers is a winner. Let's see if Nicole is going to agree. Nicole, how did you feel about it?
I liked the movie, like Rachel and Howard. I actually almost saw it twice. So the day after I watched it, I thought about going back to the theater to see it again. Just because the first time there were some interruptions, like in the theater experience was kind of annoying where I went to, at the AMC where I went to see it. However, the movie itself kind of drew me in, and I really liked it, although there were some elements of the movie that I found to be really sad. But that's another matter. I still liked the movie, even though there were some parts that were sad to me. And like Howard mentioned with the surprising elements, I do like how the movie kind of revealed little nuggets throughout the film that made it easier to kind of understand some of the characters or add another layer to their story, which made it easier to kind of see, you know, why certain things matter to certain individuals or what makes people tick. So I enjoyed that. Like just when I thought I knew something about someone, I find out I was totally off after a few scenes. So,
well, yeah, I think like most good movies, it doesn't give us everything at the beginning. It, you know, parcels out little bits and pieces of information along the way. And this is a movie about people kind of discovering the truth about one another and about their lives, and maybe shattering a little bit of the stereotypes that they have of each other and forcing them to treat one another as individuals. I always like a film that does those kinds of things, and it wasn't in your face about obvious kinds of issues. It's not like there's a sudden revelation that somebody is a good or a bad person, or that there's a history there that would change something dramatically. The closest we get to that is, you know, a piece of information that we get about Angus at the end of the film. And I don't think that was anything that was hugely disturbing to the story that we'd heard before. It just elaborates on it a little bit and makes it a little deeper. And I think we can appreciate it then. I thought the characters were all very honest. They felt very real. As a former instructor, I've often felt like I should express myself the way Mr. What's his name? Hunnam does in the film to my students, but I always resisted doing that because I don't want to discourage anybody. I was trying to be a little bit more encouraging when I interacted with my students, but I definitely felt the way he felt at particular times. That line from the trailer, and it's in the movie too, you know, the one student says, "I can't fail that class." And he says, "Oh, no, let me assure you, you're quite capable of doing that." I know that feeling. And but the opposite is also true, that when people apply themselves, they're capable of accomplishing something. And that's part of what's going on in the story also. Can people live up to their potential? It's not quite the same storyline as a film like Dead Poets Society, where it's, you know, finding what your purpose is and, you know, achieving something beyond what you're normally doing. Because this is really more about the people involved, not the studiousness that's taking place here. It's not about the academic setting, although there are some ethical questions and issues that come up in the academic discussion, which I think is one of the reasons that the film gets more interesting as it goes along. All right. And by the way, I'm with you. I think it's very good. Rachel, I think this will be a Christmas perennial for me. This is going to be one of those ones that comes up. You know, every couple of years you find a film and you say, that was a good Christmas film. I think I'll add it to my regular list. You know, last year it was Violent Night. This year will be quite different, and I think this is a good add to all of those traditions. So right after I see It's a Wonderful Life for the 49th time, I'm sure a revisit with this or Violent Night following it will make a great combination. All right, well, Howard's already mentioned one of the performers here, playing Mary Lamb, the head of the cafeteria, kind of the administrator of the cafeteria, is actress, how do you say her name? Is it Divine Joy Randolph. And I was watching this and I said, I know this woman from something. And then I suddenly realized, oh, she's the detective in Only Murders in the Building.
Okay.
That's where I knew her from. And she's very funny in that show and also very serious. In this film, I thought she was perfect as a grieving mother who's having a hard time let's face it, losing a child and going through that first year after you've lost a child and it's the holiday time. That's got to be a horrible experience for anybody. And she, you know, made a decision years earlier in her life to help her son achieve something, and it all sort of feels hollow after this event has happened, because the main reason that she took this job was so her son could go to the prep school and get the kind of education that would allow him to be something more than what he was going to probably be on the track for otherwise. And it didn't quite pan out for issues that in 1970 were pretty much, you know, in everybody's face. So Howard was hinting at that a little bit, but we'll get back to the plot issues later on. But I thought she was terrific, and I'd agree with Howard about that. Is she a leading candidate for an award? How about you, ladies? Do you think that she's award-worthy in this film?
Yeah, I absolutely do, and I think that it was just so impressive the way that there's never a moment where she isn't the smartest person in the room, that she doesn't completely know what is going on, and everybody kind of dismisses her, and is very, like, everybody's very, like, patronizing to her, not everybody, but especially at the school, you know, they're very patronizing towards her and the loss of her son and everything, and she just has everybody figured out. And I don't know, it just made her a very endearing and character that you're rooting for.
Nicole, how about you? Were you impressed with Miss Randolph's performance?
Yes, I was. And I will say I recently found out the name of the actress this weekend, and I'm not sure if I've seen her in other films, but I do want to say kudos to the casting director, because I think Divine Joy is a fitting name for someone to cast for a holiday movie as well. But I definitely enjoyed her performance, and I agree with Rachel in terms of her knowing what to do. I do think that she had, it seemed like she had a pretty good relationship with Mr. Hunnam, is it?
Yeah, Hunnam.
It seemed like they had a pretty good relationship, but with the school being patronizing to her, like, I'm not surprised. Like, that's something that, so it didn't seem like off-putting to me when I watched it. It seemed like something that would be expected given the environment that she's in, like in that setting. And yeah. Unfortunately, even today, in some settings, depending on the workplace that you're in, you know, people might be, you know, like a certain way, like towards you. So, but yeah, I'm happy that there were, you know, some positive like relationships like at that school, and that there were some people around her, like Mr. Hunnam and like the janitor.
Yeah.
Danny. Who saw her and you know, tried to comfort her in her time of grief. If she gets nominated for an award, I will definitely be happy about that. Although that wasn't something that crossed my mind while I was watching this movie. But I do think she gave a good performance. I mean, when I think of her right now, among one of the lines that I remember from watching this movie is, don't touch that goddamn record at the party. And then, you know, her speaking to Mr. Hunnam about Angus and, you know, and like, you know, like, what's wrong with you? There's a conversation in the film where she kind of highlights, even though I think she first refers to Angus as a little monster, I think so, at one point, maybe. He's unruly, but...
I think you're right. I think that she's a character that's not shy about saying what she thinks when it's time to say those kinds of things. She's, you know, obviously she's not a faculty member, so evaluating the students is not really something that she needs to be doing, and it would seem out of place for the job that she has. But when they're in the context of this relationship, where they're basically, it turns into the three of them being stuck at the school, you know, her commentary is on the nose, accurate, and also human. You know, she's suggesting that despite the fact that he is a problematic kid, he's still just a kid and needs to be treated like a person. And I think that that's an important theme. Howard, where did you get the impression that she would be kind of a leading candidate for awards? Are you following Gold Derby or some site like that?
Not just Gold Derby, but that's one of the main places. I mean, once Lily Gladstone went for Best Actress, that pretty much clears the way. And she doesn't seem to have any real competition now for supporting actress. Yeah. It's not just Gold Derby, but there are other sites too. Okay. Everybody just seems to think,
yeah,
she just has it.
I have, like I said, I've said it in the past, I try to read very little before I see a movie, so I don't really know what was going on with the talk about this. I'm going to dig into it, but I could definitely see her being a favorite. Looking back over the year, I'm not exactly sure I could pick out a lot of performances that I would put in those categories. It's an end of the year time. We're going to start getting all of this kind of awards talk. So folks who are listening, don't think that we're just hung up on it. It's timing. It's all about timing.
I think her biggest competition will probably be in The Color Purple, is my guess. I think that one has a number of performances. I haven't seen it, but...
So it all depends on whether that crashes and burns or not.
Yeah,
right. Because that would be unfortunate.
Whether it's going to be like Dreamgirls or it's going to do better.
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was so impressive that. So, with her, is talking about her son, is that too spoilery? Are we not?
No, I think it's obvious early on that. Okay. You know, so, right at the start of the film, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So I just thought it was interesting that the people are kind of using her son as sort of a way to sort of prop up their, like, look how proud we are of all that we've sacrificed and what great great contributions that we've made. And I just felt like it was like super patronizing, but in the guise of comfort, in the guise of consolation. And she got it. She understood like what was really happening and how they were using her son as some kind of badge of honor towards the greatness of their institution when he barely was, you know, a student. It wouldn't have been considered otherwise if she hadn't been working there. So things like that, I just thought it was such a nuanced role, because she's not in it that much, but she makes such a contribution. That's what a great supporting performance does.
Well, let's talk about the other performers, because there are three main performers in this film, and we've talked about Divine Joy Randolph quite a bit. I'm a fan of Paul Giamatti, but I have not seen the TV show, the program that he's been in for the last 4 or 5 years that seems to have dominated his time. I haven't seen him in a lot of movies in the last few years. I think he was in, you know, Jungle Cruise as a small part, but that was filmed 2 years before it got released, and so I don't even know how old that was. It seemed like he was working all of the time in the decade before that, and then I just didn't see him in many films in the last few years, and I was so glad to see him back on the film. You know, he's one of those performers that I think he has an everyman kind of persona that is not so much authoritative as it is. He's got that kind of despondent face, that hangdog expression, but he's got opinions and he's strong-willed, and I like that combination here. And I thought that the performance was very effective. And, you know, again, I haven't been handicapping anything, but over the years, I think he's been neglected in some categories. Going back 20 years to Sideways, I couldn't believe that he wasn't nominated for Sideways or American Splendor. And, you know, that he didn't win for Cinderella Man was also amazing to me. And it's been a long time. I've been a fan of his for a long time, and I'm glad that he's making a movie here. And I think working with Alexander Payne is probably an advantage to him. Also, they had that previous experience, and I think it shows that they are comfortable with one another when they're making this film. Did anybody have any other impressions about Giamatti in the film?
I love him. Yeah. I always love seeing Paul Giamatti. He is one of, you know, he's such a great actor, and he puts all of himself into his performances. And I really like his ability to swing back and forth between comedic scenes and dramatic scenes. And, you know, I've enjoyed him, and I have been enjoying him in Billions, the TV series that he's been in. I haven't seen a lot of the recent episodes, but from what I've watched, he's still a powerhouse in those as a, I think he plays like a divorced dude, but he's still, you know, interacting with his wife. They're like into S&M on the low. He's always a pleasure. He's always a pleasure to watch.
I like the way he just goes back and forth and does it very effectively, from being likable to unlikable to likable to unlikable. Every time you think you're going to like him, he does something that makes him look bad, and every time you think he's nothing but a bad person, he does something that makes him look good. I mean, in the opening scene, when he just treats his students very badly, and I'm thinking, if every one of his students is failing, there's something wrong with the class.
Yeah,
and only one is passing. But then he goes into the dean's office or whatever, and he refused to give a passing grade to someone just because they were the son of a senator. So suddenly he's likable again. And then I think immediately after that, he does something in the dean's office that you go, whoa, you know. And then he invites Mary to sit down with him for lunch. And at one point just tells them all off, tells all the kids off. And you just don't know. I mean, it just keeps going back and forth. I think one of the most interesting aspects of it, he says, if I wasn't babysitting you, I was just going to read a lot of mystery novels over the holiday. And I thought, yeah, that's probably true. He probably loves, he has this thing for, you know, we all have our thing. And his is mystery novels. But
yeah, you get two
I think
hours,
he does that very, very well.
2 weeks to yourself, what would you be doing if you had 2 weeks to yourself and you didn't have to worry about everything else? I know in this group, people would be watching a lot of movies, probably reading a few books, listening to some music, all kinds of things.
Well, I love how he has that box. I forget what it is, the box of books to give away.
Oh, yes. Yes. Mediations.
That was really funny. Yeah, mediations. I loved it. I mean, I've been a huge Paul Giamatti fan for a long time. I mean, even going back to sillier roles like Big Fat Liar, I absolutely really love that movie. I think it's really funny. And he was great in John Adams on HBO. He almost always delivers. I can't think of a bad Paul Giamatti performance, even in something like the Spider-Man movies. He was fine, you know, just... It was a bad role, but he's great, and he's so good in this. And I think you make a great point about that sort of vacillating between unlikability and likability. This isn't your inspirational teacher kind of narrative. It's not Captain, my Captain.
Yeah,
you know,
he's,
kind
he's
of
not heroic
story.
Figure like John Keating yeah. is. He's difficult and not necessarily mm-hmm. pleasant, but on yeah. the other hand, he. You can have a lot of sympathy for him because of some of the things that we discover along the way, and yep. I appreciated that. And he plays the part that way too. He's not avuncular and charming all the time. Although every once in a while there's something creeps in that just says there is a human being in there, and you appreciate yeah. that.
Yeah, and he has integrity at his core, which. Keeps you rooting for the character even in sort of more unlikable moments.
Well, how about young Dominic? He appears to have not done anything before this. I looked him up and I said, who is this guy? And he was literally a student at one of the prep schools that they filmed at. I don't know that that's where they found him, but that's the only connection I could find to the film. So this is his first film, it's his first credit, and I thought he was great.
Yeah, well, unbelievable.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I'd say great, but he's very good, especially for a first film.
Yeah, I liked him given
I can believe it was his first role.
Nicole, you started yeah. to say something.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wasn't aware that he didn't do any, you know, that he hasn't done any previous films like you, Richard. So I'm glad that you discovered that. And I, as someone who has casted people just off of the street randomly for my own films, I think he, when controlling for that aspect, I think he did a pretty good job. Even though I didn't like the character, Angus, Dominic pulled it off pretty well.
Well, he has a couple of really good scenes and also a couple of really good laughs. We're not quite in spoiler territory yet, but I will mention that there is a moment where... after an accident, he appears on screen, and I thought I was going to bust a gut laughing as they're trying to get in the car. It was just a little too on the nose.
That was funny, yeah.
Well, you know, I usually have a variety of things that I want to talk about. I don't want to ignore anything that you guys wanted to talk about, though, before I get into a couple of other things that I'd mention. Is there something in particular that anybody else wanted to bring up?
I would like to eventually talk about the ending. That is the only thing that I'm a little mixed on in the movie, is the ending. I think it works, but how they get there to the ending, I'm a little mixed on.
All right.
But I still really enjoyed it.
We'll come back to that in a minute then. Howard, you were talking about maybe the film doesn't address some of the political issues
that it ought to deal with. Well,
the racial issues.
Yeah,
okay.
More the racial issues. I mean, it does some. You know, when Paul Giamatti asked Mary to sit down with him for dinner, and the one kid obviously thinks he's too good to sit with her, though that might not just be because it's black, but because she's the hired help. And I agree that their exploitation of her son is very condescending. But I think there are two things that are missing that I wanted to see. One is when she goes to that restaurant. This lily white restaurant in 1969, and no one thinks it's odd that a black patron comes in.
Well, it is in Boston. Sure, Boston. It's not in Alabama. It's in Boston. You know,
it doesn't matter. They could, New York City and Boston and big Chicago can be even worse than the South. It's a myth that only the South does all these things.
Well, I'm not saying that there weren't situations like that, but I don't think it was necessarily likely or probable that it would be that way. So I didn't find it disconcerting. I did find the interaction with the waitress to be a little frustrating. And in the typical sort of situation, I appreciated that their solution was a little bit less abrasive than Jack Nicholson's solution to trying to order food in a restaurant. But
I was on the waitress's side in this film, as I was on the waitress's side in Five Easy Pieces. I mean, I felt sorry for the waitress in both cases,
well,
because the waitress is only following the law.
They're following their procedure. Yeah, they're following their procedure, what they're supposed to do.
Right, how, I mean, it's the law. They can't do it legally. And they could be closed down.
I don't know that that was the issue, but I'm not going to debate that here or there. Because of the very thing that they point out, all the alcohol burns off in the Cherry's Jubilee. You know, and same thing with Bananas
exactly.
Foster.
It's almost all. There's still a little that remains in there, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, it's the restaurant's policy, and she needs to say. But there are ways that you can communicate that and be a little bit more manageable, and as opposed to being bureaucratic. And I think that that's the problem that I see there.
I suppose. I think we'll have to disagree on that, because I just felt sorry for her. She said very clearly, we can't do that. He's underage, and they just kept giving her a hard time about it. If I was the waitress, I'd want to throw them out. But what I'm also missing is I wanted at some point for Mary Lamb to say her son was not really treated well at this school.
Well, we don't know that he wasn't treated well at the school. Why do you
exactly.
want him to say
we
that?
We don't know. That's my point. We don't know. And I wanted her to say, you know, they're doing all this about my son, and they think he's this great person here, but when he was going to school here, he was not treated well. And I think it's, for me, it's missing certain racial, politically racial aspects of the story. My point is, it's not there. We don't know, but I would find it hard to believe that they didn't treat him badly. I think it would be almost impossible that they didn't. And now they're exploiting him. And I just wanted her to mention that at some time. I know how he was thought about here. And
yeah, I mean, I think at the very least, you know that he wasn't like the favorite son, you know, that now that he's dead, oh, we can prop him up as this beloved, you know, kind of member of our alumni. And they were so sad, you know, that, and I think at the very least that was like clear to me that they were patronizing her with that, and that she was, that it was frustrating for her.
Well, I'm gonna interject something here from a slightly different perspective, and I'm not discounting what you're saying, and I could definitely see why it would be perceived that way. However, you know, they're making a public address of this kind of thing, and it is difficult to either ignore it in the situation or to say the right thing in the situation. Mm-hmm. And and when you're speaking to an audience, and if, especially in this context, it's they're getting ready for the holiday. It's a religious service that they're at. Even though it's, you know, not particularly religious, but it's a priest who's basically leading the whole thing and is making the presentation, trying to balance between supportive and the audience that you're talking to, that's a tough line to walk. And the fact that it came off condescending, I understand that completely. But I also think that they're trying to be like he intended to comfort her with those words, regardless of, and you know, I think if we had a whole backstory about what happened with his experience at the school, that's a completely different movie.
I disagree. It's not a completely different movie at all. It's right on point.
Well, it's suddenly about a different person and about a different series of events and the changes that people are going through. We have a picture of him. That's all we know about him.
I was fine with that being understated. To me, that made it kind of an interesting dynamic of, again, like, she's the smartest person in the room at all times. She understands what's happening, and that made her an interesting character. I didn't need it all be spelled out what happened to her son, at least to me, it made her a more dynamic, interesting character than just sort of the grieving widow.
Yeah, well, I think that that's true. It's pretty obvious that she has a better understanding of human nature than anybody else picture. When you say she's the smartest person in the room, in that regard, that is definitely the case. She understands people better. She would probably have given a better speech. It would not be appropriate for her to be doing it in that context.
Well, she is a type. She is the magic Negro. And, you know, so there is that. But they're all familiar types.
Yeah, well, we talked about the whole picture is full of these, you know, archetypes. Right. And it's like I said at the beginning, the film could feel very derivative if you were just thinking, oh, you know, it's a prep school, it's all boys, we've got, you know, contentious relationships between the teachers and the students that have to be overcome, somebody has to get inspired, somebody has to challenge the rules. I've seen this movie before, but we haven't, even though we think we have, because there are these kinds of variations.
All right. So there's a scene where she tells Howard, when you were saying that you wish that she would have like mentioned Curtis, it made me think about the scene where she told Mr. Hunnam that her son hated him when he said, you know, I had him once. He was very insightful. And she's like, he hated you. And he was like, like I said.
He was smart and insightful. That was a good line. This is a film that was set in 1970. It's set in a part of the world that I'm not from, but I've seen in 1,000 other movies, you know, New England, at wintertime. I'm certainly glad I'm not in that part of the world in wintertime. Nicole, you're the closest to that. You're in Philadelphia, right?
Yes, I am, and it is cold.
So I'm watching this, and I'm going, this feels pretty much like the time period. I didn't see any anachronisms. I didn't notice anything that made me think, oh, they really had to struggle to make this look like 1970. I thought they did a pretty good job in kind of finding locations. The schools, of course, especially. You know, obviously, they just didn't film in the new sections of most of those prep schools that they filmed at. They just found the more traditional sections. I would remember walking around my college campus, and there were buildings that you go, oh, well, this is clearly from, you know, the 1930s, built during the, you know, WPA period. And then there were other buildings that were like built during the 1960s. It was like, oh, this is the architecture of, you know, the state, you know, it's like Stalinist Russia, you know. And then you get the more contemporary modernist things that are thrown in. And if you just look in the right building in the right place, I think you can find something that would fit that time period. And I thought they did a good job in that.
Well, I did like the fact that when they went to Boston, you didn't see like the Eiffel Tower if you go to Paris.
Yes.
And they were in some neighborhoods where I'm going, most people would never shoot a scene like this in these just everyday neighborhoods. So I thought that was really interesting. The only thing that I always feel is a little bit not anachronistic, the costumes were accurate, but people didn't have this good a taste in clothing at the time. This was like the worst period for male fashion ever. But they're all very subdued.
You were looking for the
very good taste.
You were looking for those checked pants with the bell bottom flares.
Yeah, the Bob Newhart. You know, which is what some of them, the father or the stepfather would have been dressed.
Oh, the button down like shirt, you know, kind of thing. Yeah.
But they do that a lot because they all know this is such an awful period for fashion that if you want, unless you're doing a comedy, you tend to subdue the fashion of the time.
Do you still have a Nehru jacket in your closet someplace, Howard?
No, I can't. But I barely have anything that I could have fit in at one time anymore. I've outgrown all of it. But I remember, oh, some of the stuff I wore. What was I thinking? You know? And mixing stripes and
the paisley shirts and the scarves.
Which can work if you have good taste, but I didn't.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, can we talk about the ending a
little
bit? Yeah,
I was just going to say, we're going to put up the warning for anybody listening that we're going to cross the Rubicon now. This is the spoiler wall that's coming down, and we're going to talk a little bit more about plot elements and particularly about the ending of the film. So those of you who are listening and don't want to have any foreknowledge of what goes on at the in the last part of the story, this is the time to tune out and come back and listen to us after you've seen the movie. Rachel, you are obviously itching to get to this, so let's go there.
Well, I mean, I still gave the movie a very high score. I just felt like he didn't have enough information to have made a decision that would have these kind of ramifications, I felt like. I just feel like the people at this clinic that this dad was at would have given him some kind of warning of like, we don't recommend him seeing, or we don't recommend this meetup happening, or it was really hard to get him here, or he's not in a stable place, or something that would have given him a heads up of like, okay, if I allow this to happen, it's a big deal. And so I felt, I mean, and yeah, life isn't always fair, but it just kind of felt unfair to the character that like, and it just felt like, okay, I just don't think that this would happen. I feel like everybody would have had way more sort of knowledge. And when the visit was happening, it was all just kind of like, okay, this is fine. There was no sense of like they're breaking protocol and rules, or very little sense of that, aside from the fact that his mother, you know, might not love it, but that it was a fireable offense seemed a little, I think that could have been done better.
Well, I think, go ahead, Howard. I don't want to jump in over you.
I think you have a point that he has no problem getting in to see his father. I'm not sure I thought about it at the time, but now that you mention it, yeah, I would even expect them to have something on file that says, do not let the son in to see his father. So I get your point. I also wonder just how they managed to smuggle that humongous snow globe and nobody noticed it. I mean, I wonder where he put it in his clothes, father.
We did,
in his clothes.
Yeah, we didn't see it being taken into the into the sanatorium, and we didn't see it being given to the father. We learn about it only afterwards, and that does feel like it's one of those moments where, well, there was no foreshadowing that there was going to be a problem as a consequence of this, and it simply becomes an additional excuse to go after Mr. Hunnam.
Well, I think that's the thing. He's not really being fired only for this.
No, that was the point I was going to make earlier, is that he's obviously been a thorn in the side of the headmaster because of his obstinance about passing the student earlier and his unwillingness to cooperate in regard to the kids who are privileged and expect to be able to go to Cornell. And he says, I'm going to Cornell. And he says, I don't think so. You know, it's like he's just he is a figure that is looking to be eliminated. And this is just, you know, like you say, the final straw, the straw that broke the camel's back. It's just one more thing that gives a justification. And the fact that the parents are the ones who are all up in arms about it. And of course, he throws himself under the bus for the whole thing. So I think that's the thing that makes it more meaningful, and not just that he's being singled out for some unfair treatment. He's basically, you know, throwing himself on the grenade to save Angus.
I mean, he doesn't even have a college degree. So he's just an adjunct professor. He's not even a professor. So he doesn't really have the qualifications in many ways to teach there as it is. He's only been there as a favor to somebody. And now finally they can get rid of him.
Yeah, well, that's maybe somebody's reasoning, although I don't know what the faculty or the staff know about all that. You would think they'd have insight on that, but let's face it, there's probably not a lot of paperwork going back 30 years that indicates all that kind of stuff. Nobody knows that. And by the way, the fact that he doesn't have a degree doesn't necessarily mean that much. He was in his senior year. It was the final thesis that resulted in them being, you know, the whole incident with his roommate. So it's like, okay, so I got to the end of college and I didn't get the piece of paper, although I did, you know, 3¾ years at Harvard. I'm not sure that makes you unqualified to be teaching at a prep school. I think you're probably quite qualified, and especially given what we know about his meticulous knowledge of history and the way he teaches his classes, he seems to be, you know, competent in that. Now, whether or not he's a good teacher, that's another issue.
I just think I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say that has nothing to do with he's qualified to teach. He could be a better teacher than everybody there, but if he's only an adjunct professor and only got the position because someone did him a favor, which he states that's the only.
Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing with that.
Yeah,
that, I'm just saying.
Okay, sorry.
I just think if he knew that this was a big risk that he was taking him to see his father, that this was a possible fireable offense, it would have made the whole scene way more tense and way more, because you knew that this was like, whoa, this was a big deal. And because it never felt that heavy to me, I was kind of like, again, not a deal breaker, I still gave it a very high score, but I was just kind of like, this just doesn't feel fair. I don't know. I just think it would have like added some weight to like, when he decides to do it, if he knew that doing it was as big a deal as it ended.
Well, they didn't expect it to become a thing. They didn't know that the family would learn about it. It's only because of the consequences that we didn't see happen that the family found out about it.
Right, and now they're all of a sudden at the school, and now all of a sudden they want to be present and
they're the
which
ones
makes
who are...
a lot of this not fair, because with Angus here, you have a boy who feels isolated and feels like nobody loves him, and he's stuck on this large campus during the holidays, and it seemed like the staff at Barton, particularly Mr. Hunnam, and even maybe Mary, became like surrogate parental figures for him, which was nice. And that I think I do agree with Rachel in terms of the turn of events. But at the same time, because I'm not a fan of it, I do feel for him. But maybe I should have more patience with kids. I've been a teaching artist in different school, middle schools, high schools, and I think maybe I've been lucky to be around some kids who aren't really unruly, or I haven't had a large responsibility to babysit kids for like weeks at a time. But like Angus, I was so over him during the gym scene. Like the gym was off limits, and so I felt like when Mr. Hunnam decided to throw himself under the bus to sacrifice himself for this kid who isn't even his son, I felt like that is a lot to really put your career on the line and everything that you stand for and everything that you've been trying to do and instill in the student population at Barton. You're gonna risk all of that for Angus? Really? Like this dude, now unfortunately he is in an unfortunate situation because his mom and his stepdad suck.
Yeah.
Like
thank you for saying it.
They are the worst.
Terrible people.
I don't think it's right that Mr. Hunnam, you know, loses his job to try to help this student. But like you said, Richard, I think Richard said it, that, you know, that the headmaster was like itching for a reason to throw him out. But it even makes me more sad about Mr. Hunnam's situation, especially considering the scene in Boston when they ran into one of his old schoolmates. And he made up this entire story about how he was traveling and teaching at private institutions. And it's like, why do you care about what other people think of you? I felt sad for him in that instance, because for all of his intelligence as a person and experience in teaching, it's a shame that he still feels the need to pretend to be someone else. However, his own experiences growing up, as he mentioned when they were in the store, that explained why he's so anal about building character, working hard, and like enforcing the rules at Barton, regardless of the social status of the students there and their parents. But
I sort of like the rationalization that he gives to himself and to Angus about the whole thing. He may in fact suffer from, you know, embarrassment or awkwardness. But the way he expressed it is, I think, the thing that makes us more empathetic to him. He says, it's my story. He's not entitled to it, and I don't want to share it with him. And I kind of like that sort of self-rationalization that he's giving, you know, that I don't need to tell him the truth about anything because he's not a part of my life. This is my story. He's not entitled to it. And I like that.
He knew that if this kid gets sent off to military school, which was the next step, that's it. It's done. He knew that that would break this young man.
Well, yeah, he identifies with the kid as a result of that. You know, this is it's the same kind of thing happening here. If the kid gets unjustly punished for something
visiting
that's
his
happened,
father.
Yeah, for this, and his life is going to go in a completely different direction as a consequence. Well, that's Paul Hunnam's story.
Yeah. It's also more than just he's going to military school, because they do say this, but it's rather vague. After military school, it's Vietnam.
that's true.
And yeah, so he wanted to make sure he didn't have to go there. I considered it a happy ending, though. I think this is the greatest thing to ever happen.
That's interesting.
Well, it forces him out of his shell. He can't hide in the school anymore. He has to go out and face the world. I think that's good news. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he has an attitude about it, I like that especially. By the way, Lisa Leahy on the show a couple of weeks ago was talking about Chekhov's clothesline. You know, you see the clothesline earlier in the story, and you know that's going to be used to decapitate somebody later in a story. I was thinking about Chekhov's whiskey in this gun. Particular film.
Well, it's Chekhov's gun.
You know, mm-hmm. yeah. You know, mm-hmm. and so there it is. It shows up in the story, and you're going, it gets a reference. They talk about it a little bit. There's a shot on it. This has got to come back up in the story someplace. And I was glad that it did in the way that it did. You know, it was like, yeah, well, here's what I think of it as he's driving off. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I do recommend the makeup for the dislocated shoulder.
Oh, yes.
I have dislocated my shoulder. It's incredibly painful to get it back, but you feel wonderful afterwards. But that looked really real.
Well, the reaction shot that Paul Giamatti has when they're tying those sheets around him to yank his arm into position, and then you hear the sound, and we don't see it happen, but we see the reaction. I thought that was another good scene for him. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's get to our final thoughts on this film and some Lamb scores. So, Nicole, let's start with you. Final thoughts and a Lamb score out of 5.
I'll give it a 5. I guess I wasn't upset with the movie, and I'm giving it a 5 based on the fact that I was willing to go back to see it again just cause, like, oh, I think I might have an extra few hours. What am I doing tomorrow? I should just go watch this again. I also want to give a nod to Carrie Preston, actress Carrie Preston, who plays Miss Lydia Crane. I thought that she had a crush on him when she gave a crush on Mr. Hunnam when she gave him the cookies earlier in the movie. And then, like, later, I guess that wasn't the case. at her Christmas party, we learned that. But I think that she was a nice ray of sunshine in this movie at different points for Mr. Hunnam.
Yeah, she seemed like a very normal character in the circumstances, the kind of person that you might expect to encounter on a regular basis, somebody who treats others respectfully and doesn't have an agenda. Howard, how about you? You got a Lamb score for us? And some final thoughts?
Well, I think it's a very entertaining movie that you could recommend just about anybody to see. I'm not going to call it a great work of art by any means, but it's very enjoyable and it's very moving, and it doesn't quite... I thought it was going to be Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and it's not. So that was all for the better. I'm torn between 3.5 to 4 stars. So I'll just go ahead and give it 4.
And Rachel, how many lambs are you going to give the holdovers?
I'm going to give it 4.5. I really enjoyed it. I loved the script. I thought it was so entertaining. It's the kind of movie that will make you laugh. It'll make you cry. It'll make you just feel for the characters and just give you it all. And I really loved the performances. It's maybe my favorite movie of the year. It's up there for sure.
That just reminds me, if you've ever seen Hardware Wars, the satire of Star Wars, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll kiss $12 goodbye.
Well, I think kissing my $12 goodbye was worth it in this particular case. I'm going to agree with Rachel. I'm going to give it a 4.5. I thought it was one of the better films I've seen this year. I'm a little bit like some of the other folks on the show. I hesitate to give anything a 5 after the first viewing of it. I think I'm going to have to come back to it and see. But when I think about the movies that I've seen this year, I like this one very much, enjoyed it quite a bit. I appreciated that it was, you know, a film made for people who could sit and watch a movie for 2 hours and 10 minutes and not people who needed to sit someplace for 3.5 hours just because it was the director's preference to do it that way. Or, you know, people with the attention span that says, I have to fill every second with something going on for 2.5 hours if I'm going to make the movie. It's just like an adult movie. It's the kind of thing that I remember seeing all the time in the past, and you don't see quite as often anymore. And I'm glad that it's in theaters for people to see and not just playing on some streaming service. So I thought the performances were great, and like I said, I think it'll be a Christmas perennial. Well, we're going to come back for a quick discussion, but first we're going to hear from some fellow Lamb Podcasting Network shows before we get to our exit question.
Hi, I'm Jason Soto.
And I'm Lisa Leahy.
And we're the host of Between the Scares, a podcast that takes a look at every movie that Blumhouse Productions has made. You may not recognize the name, but they have made some of your favorite horror movies like Paranormal Activity, Ouija, and Insidious.
Yeah, Jason, but they've also made stupid movies like The Fever and Best Night Ever and Hysterical Blindness.
Yeah, those two. But they also did Whiplash, Get Out, and Us, and we're going to cover it all.
Hey, did you know that Jason Blum also produced that Gem and the Holograms live-action movie?
He did that?
Uh-huh.
Ugh, fine. But then you have to watch The Green Inferno. So listen to Between the Scares on Anchor, Apple, Google, Amazon, or our home location at rabbitholepodcast.com.
Welcome back, everybody. It's time for our exit question of the week. And this week, the question is, of course, based on the film that we saw this week. There are just a ton of these movies where students and teachers come together, especially at prep schools. Even the Harry Potter films kind of fit in this category, and they seem to manage to draw people in on a regular basis. I think of, you know, Dead Poets Society as well as The Holdovers, and there have been a dozen other movies. You know, we talked about Goodbye, Mr. Chips before, which has been remade and is a musical, and it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, there are a lot of these kinds of movies. So the question is, why do films featuring teacher-student relations seem to resonate with film-going audiences? And do they resonate with you also? So does somebody want to start with this question? Somebody have an answer that they feel really covers it?
I think maybe these films resonate with moviegoers because deep down it gives us a chance to relive our youth, for better or worse. So some moviegoers might want to do... They might want a do-over after having a not-so-great experience in their youth, while other moviegoers might want to go back to a period when they were having the best time of their lives. I know for me, films featuring teacher-student relations do resonate with me depending on the plot and the setting. So, for example, I could relate to some of the challenges depicted in Lean On Me, starring Morgan Freeman, with standardized testing being a thing that makes or breaks the future of a public school, despite its lack of resources, staffing problems, safety issues, and other factors that plague the student body and faculty, thus affecting their ability to thrive in a hostile learning environment. Whereas with Bad Teacher, starring Cameron Diaz, I just wanted a good laugh and to be entertained. But I was initially drawn to Bad Teacher because for many people who have either attended a public school or worked at a public school or even visited a public school, I was at one earlier this year for my niece's stage performance of a sister act too, I think, which was entertaining. But for, you know, many people who are familiar with public schools in one way or another, if you are, you've either had or witnessed teachers who obviously couldn't care less about their job or the students that they were hired to educate. So that's how Bad Teacher initially resonated with me. And then I wanted to go see it because I knew it would be funny. And which makes me think of the TV show that's out right now, Abbott Elementary, actually. As someone who does live in Philadelphia, in Abbott, where Abbott Elementary is set, that show is very accurate, unfortunately. and so, you know, these there are teachers who are just there to get, who are just there for the for a paycheck. So I appreciate the few teachers, like my high school English teacher, Miss Satchel, for example, and my social studies teacher, Mr. Bannister, who really challenged their students. Now, they weren't as, you know, as strict and uptight as Mr. Hunnam in the holdovers, but they always challenged their students, and they took their profession seriously and cared about the development of their students, which is why I also loved Mona Lisa Smile, starring Julia Roberts, so much that I bought the DVD to watch it again, because I liked how she wanted, how the teacher wanted to expand the horizons of the students in her class, despite, you know, politics in the school and despite societal pressures or traditions of how a woman is supposed to be or what goals she's supposed to have. And in the midst of, you know, rebellious students in the class, she still wanted to open their minds a bit more. And so that's my guess on why films resonate.
I think there's probably a lot of truth in that, you know, the nostalgia that we have, and then also the fact that we are looking at things that, you know, we've seen ourselves. That probably explains it. You know, it's easy to relate to something that you're familiar with. You know, people say, you know, familiarity breeds contempt, but it also breeds interest. I think that's the case. Rachel, how about you? Why do you think these films resonate with people?
Yeah, it was interesting. There were, for the most part, it was huge praise for The Holdovers, but there were a few people on Letterboxd and other places that were like, I can't relate to this story about a bunch of rich white kids. And I was just like, oh boy. I mean, if characters in a film have to be exactly like you in order for you to find them relatable, then you're only going to like two movies in your life. Like, But what I think the reason why school stories tend to resonate so much with us is that we all went to school. Even homeschoolers still do school of some kind. It's just part of our experience. So it is easy to connect with. It also kind of gets to the heart of sort of group think and group behavior, which is just sort of fascinating. And so, like, even if we're not in school, we're still usually in groups. We have group dynamics. And so you, it's amazing how within, like, if you're doing a play or you're in a service group or whatever it is, like, you have the nerd, you have the leader, you have the, you know, the curmudgeon who doesn't want to be there. You have all those dynamics. And so I think even if you're out of school, you can remember school, but then you can also relate. I mean, that's why I loved Clueless so much growing up is the way that she kind of breaks down the Amy Heckerling breaks down the dynamics of high school and the different groups and the group mentality and the trads and the trends and the fads and everything going on with that. And that's why it's so funny all these years later. And so whether it's emotion or humor, I think that that's sort of why it just creates a very natural social structure that then you can kind of mine for humor and emotion and everything else.
All right. Howard, do you think it's the archetypes that get us into these movies?
Well, I'm not really sure. I don't really identify with movies that focus on teachers or teacher-student relationship, except maybe things like The Paper Chase. I identify more with things like The Last Picture Show and The 400 Blows. And I think you mentioned, what was that Amy Heckerling film?
Clueless?
The other one.
Oh, but, Fast Times at Richmond High.
Yeah.
Fast Times at Richmond High. I sometimes think that, and this is just a feeling I have because I can't speak for other people, that it's like that movie Summer of 42, where the tagline is, in every boy's life, there's a summer of 42. And it's like, in every person's life, there's this mythical teacher that never really existed, but they wish it had, and somehow it becomes this fantasy of how they grew up. But of course, that's a feeling. They may have actually had this one great teacher that changed their whole life. The closest I came was in college. And to show you how I feel, I enjoy Dead Poets Society. I don't think he's a very good teacher. So that's sort of how I sort of feel about it. It's more fantasy mythology. It's like watching Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. You know, you can't really identify them, but the fantasy is great.
No, I think there's a lot to what you're saying there. It is a sense of wish fulfillment that we find, you know, a teacher that is got integrity, is somebody who cares about human beings, is inspirational. And I think most of our teachers were probably good people, although there are always exceptions, who didn't necessarily live up to our hopes that they would be, you know, the kind of inspirational person that comes and saves us, you know, from, you know, how green our valley is to, you know, a little princess or Mr. Chips or Dead Poets Society or any of those other kinds of films. I know that there are times when, you know, we look back on the things that have happened to us and we say, boy, you know, if I could only do then what I know now, you know, I would be a better student. I would make more out of my opportunities at the time. And I think maybe that's part of what we're also seeing here is it gives us a chance to say, yeah, I wouldn't have done that, or I would do that now, or that's how I would feel about things, or I would kind of relate to this in a different way in our more mature states. Maybe the problem, it's not so much a problem, but it's also, like I said, fantasy fulfillment. Every time I think of a movie like Mr. Holland's Opus and you know, the end where suddenly everything pays off at the end, I say, yeah, it just isn't like that. You know, once in a while you get a little pat on the back as a teacher, but you're not going to get that moment where all of your former students show up and perform your you know, your concert piece in front of an appreciative audience. That ain't happening. It's just,
yeah, that's true.
It's just change in people is incremental. And the advantage of seeing it in a movie is that we get to see it happen when we wouldn't notice it in real life. So I think that that's probably part of what's going on there as well. Well, that's been our show this week. Everybody on this show thinks that you all probably ought to see this movie and that you'll be entertained by it. Let's figure out what we're going to see next time. I don't know. I'll have to read a book. I'll have to look at a newspaper. I'll have to go online and study. Maybe I can find a monograph that'll make some recommendations. So until next time, I want to thank my guests and give them a chance to plug anything that they think would be helpful. Howard, thank you very much for showing up, and I'm going to be thanking you again in a few minutes, but you got something that you would like to plug this week?
Well, as usual, ad nauseum, it's Pop Art, my podcast, where right now the most recent one is the Halloween episode is still up with Lisa Leahy, where we did The Ring and Curse of the Demon, two films about cursed objects that only give you a certain amount of time to live. The one I will, I am working on editing now was with Sean Homrig, a lawyer by day, murder mystery, party planner by night, where we did The Ice Storm in Peyton Place, two soap opera films about their time periods. I'm going to go ahead and mention that the one that I just recorded was with author Jennifer Van Seil, who wrote a book on screenwriting, visual screenwriting, I think is the name, where we did Parasite and La Ceremonie, two movies about servants that turned a bit deadly. And so since you're here, Richard, I have to mention that after that, we will be doing, since it's November and election month, we'll be doing The Candidate and Bob Roberts, both about people running for election, one a liberal, one a conservative. And I should go ahead and mention the Christmas episode with Jay, where we're doing something a little different. This time I chose the pop culture film and Jay chose the other one, just for fun. And I chose Windchill and he chose Dead End. And they're both about people going home for the holidays and something supernatural and really bad happens.
Cool. A little change of pace there. I like that. Yeah. Rachel, you got something that you want us to turn our eyes to or ears to?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing for me right now is over at the Hallmarkies podcast, we are covering all things holiday, and including all of the Hallmark films. There's 3 to 4 every single weekend. There's, I think, 10 over the course of the Thanksgiving week. So just in Hallmark, we'll be covering Lifetime and UpTV and feature films and Disney Plus and just anything Christmas we cover, including we'll be talking holdovers eventually. If you like holiday films, you can't miss. It's a fun podcast. I'm real proud of it.
Excellent. And Nicole, how about you? Something that we should be looking for?
Yes, I will be publishing an interview with a director of an Academy Award qualifying film coming soon, and also a movie review for a short comedy called The Jeffrey Diaries. That's about a company that hires a camera person to make video diaries following the life of Lou, a carer with learning difficulties. However, her mischievous client has other ideas as he battles against his past, fame, and virginity. So that's what I have on the horizon so far.
Okay. Well, it sounds like everybody's got something interesting in their near future, and we'll look forward to hopefully getting a chance to look at those things and maybe talk about them down the road. Once again, thank you all my guests and everybody else. You know, I hope that you have somebody to spend the holidays with other than Mr. Hunnam. Have a good one, folks. Bye. All right.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review. Go to hell.
Be careful, it could go off for like no reason.